I honestly feel like it's really imperative that we do things like amaranth, because they're an eat-all green. Hausantle is an eat-all green. You can have the grains to make flour. You can eat the seeds like a porridge. You can eat the leaves. You can eat the microgreens. Those kind of plants are the kind of plants that are going to save us in those crisis time periods. So I would say doing that for starters would be really the best way to take the first steps to preparing for these food prices to skyrocket. Because scaling up growing food is absolutely ridiculously easy. Humans would not have survived. We just would not have survived if that wasn't the case. So it's the linchpin. Seeds are the linchpin. It's easy to get these like gritty, resilient, amazing seeds if you treat them right and if you let them express themselves.
I'm Christian, and this is the Ice Age Farmer Podcast. We just heard some highlights from a conversation that I'm thrilled to be sharing with you today, one with Matt Powers. Matt is a permaculture teacher, an author, an educator. He's the author of this book, The Permaculture Student 2, which is both a beautiful book and an awesome collection of regenerative practices and solutions. I highly recommend it. You can find Matt and this book, as well as his others, at thepermaculturestudent.com. We were prompted by the flooding in the Midwest, which is threatening food price increases across the board, as well as a host of other threats to modern agriculture, to have a conversation today about enthusiasm, for one, and how easy and fun it can be to grow your own food. Matt is just a really inspiring guy. He's a wealth of knowledge. We'll talk for the first hour about his background and his story, how he found permaculture, and then we'll get directly into exactly the kind of knowledge with which we all must be armed so that we have the confidence to grow our own food and to teach others, especially going forward. So I thank you for joining me today, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I certainly did. A huge thanks to Matt for taking the time to speak with me. And without any further ado, Matt Powers is an author, educator, permaculture teacher, and a family guy. He's also currently an entrepreneur focused on radically transforming the school experience for children everywhere by aligning their education with current regenerative science, natural principles, and clear ethics, earth care, people care, and future care. He also possesses unstoppable enthusiasm, which is one of the main reasons he's here today, and I'm thrilled to have him. Matt, I'm really just super excited to connect. I am also, to be completely honest, I'm honored to speak with you. I find both you personally and your work both very inspiring. So it's just an honor to speak with you. Also, you're pumping out great content to YouTube lately, just like rapidly pushing it out there. So I wanted to call attention to that and get some more eyes on that. But it's awesome. Thanks for joining.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure. You are going to the edges of a lot of emergent ideas, concepts, movements, and people, and you're really highlighting them. And some of them touch upon, you know, ancient traditions that are coming back, and others are, you know, the cutting edge. And it's really awesome. So thank you for having me on, and thank you for doing the work you're doing.
It's entirely my pleasure. I got so many questions to ask you. This is gonna be fun. I do want to step back and sort of introduce you a little bit. So you weren't always a permaculture teacher and guru. Can I ask you to like step back and just share a little bit about how you found permaculture, what inspired you to get started into it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it'll probably explain why I'm different than most educators online and stuff, and why I try to make it more lateral than the guru thing. But I was a musician. I was a bass player. I played with Sean Pelton from Saturday Night Live, the house drummer for the past, you know, 20-odd years. And I played with Rachel Ray's husband, John Cusimano. I mean, the crazy thing was I started playing with John when I was 18. And there was no, like, expectation of, you know, working and going traveling and all this stuff. I mean, we were just, you know, people in New York City making music. And it just turned into this thing. We ended up traveling all over the world together. I was there at his wedding. You know, it was really wild. And it was my dream. I got to, you know, arrive at my dream at a very young age, actually. I went from starting playing bass at age 16, teaching myself in a jazz context, to playing with professionals in Electric Lady Studios, you know, in the former bedroom of Jimi Hendrix, where, you know, Weezer recorded their Blue Album when I was, you know, I think 19, 20. And by the time I think it was like 22, there was like, that cars picking me up to go to gigs and like airports and stuff. So it all perhaps went to my head. Certain things happened in my life. Certain pieces fell apart in that process. And in that process, I met my wife and I cleaned my act up. And then she got cancer. And because my values had like really changed, I was more of a family guy, less of a party guy. When that happened, I was able to really reevaluate everything. And through a painful process, I arrived at that I needed to leave New York City at basically the real moment where I really started digging in and getting the respect of people like Sean Pelton. And all these other real professional musicians, where I was just a kid that I was learning from them. And it was so painful, but it was the right thing to do. And it's what my wife needed to recover. Because she got thyroid cancer, and then we did the radiation. And then 3 months later, she got two different bouts of melanoma that went so deep that it almost reached her lymph nodes. Mm. And once it reaches your lymph nodes, it's basically end game. Maybe not now with what we know. But back then it definitely was. And so she had multiple surgeries. She had the ablation of her thyroid. It was absolute hell on earth. Mm. I mean, when someone comes in a radioactive suit holding a case that has a case inside of it and goes like this, and goes, you open the inside case, and runs out of the room. And you're supposed to open the inside case and then take the pill out and then take it. But they just ran out of the room. That's what my wife had to do. And so the psychological damage, that all that does, and then my wife's smart, right? So she goes out in the waiting room realizing everyone else is doing the same procedure and they're all talking about it. These are all old ladies. She's 22. She's the only young person there. So they're all talking to her. She's realizing they're going home on public transportation, spreading radioactivity everywhere, causing more cancer and attacking everyone's thyroid, because for 6 months, that sweaty palm that touches that surface on that bus is radioactive. So, and there's an argument as to actually, is it much longer because of the half-life? Depends on where you cut that threshold off. So these are the things I figured out because we had a young baby, and I basically became hysterically mad at the system. And like, I was already, you know, a person whose brother had, you know, connected him to Noam Chomsky in high school. And I'm like pen-palling Chomsky about what's going on with like 9/11 and getting like peace of mind by turning to like, you know, someone that actually trusts on a lot of this stuff. And so it was just this like very hard time period in my life, and it was pressure, and it forced me to change. I went out to the West Coast and I tried doing the music thing again in LA. It was a 4-hour commute. I lived half the time in LA, actually, with one of my best friends, producer Peter Simon, who worked with Dave Jordan, who worked with Jane's Addiction. He was Brian Eno's protege. And I actually ended up doing a national tour with them as myself and their bass player. So I was playing two shows a night, but I got to do my dream again. You know, I got to be the musician, but it ultimately went sour again for me because I saw my family suffer without me at home. And so what happened is my wife kept getting cancer. And then I kept having to become more and more serious. And so I stopped traveling. I stopped touring. I eventually stopped doing like music, like trying to make it. And I became a substitute teacher. And it was like a little bit in denial. I brought my guitar with me into the classroom. Listen to this. You kids are going to love this. No, but yeah. And some of the kids loved it. And some of the kids are actually musicians now because of that. And I was a teacher, and some of the students have put out albums, and yeah. So, that I love music, and I don't want to, you know, like turn my back on that. I'm still, I write, you know, I'm constantly writing, you know, SNL's drummer. And he's like, yeah, that's crazy, man. And so, like, I my heart is deeply into that space. But when I became a sub and saw what was going on with the kids' education, it burned me so deeply. I was, I had, in many ways a hard childhood, but in many ways, completely not a hard childhood, completely given all the greatest gifts that you could ever be given because I was given such a good education. And there are, you know, complications in everyone's life. There are traumas. There are things that we have, you know, post-traumatic stress from, you know. Sure. But overall, I was given so much and given so many opportunities, and I didn't understand. And so when I went to Fresno and saw the absolute malnutrition educationally and the way these kids were being treated, it tore me up inside. And so there became this, like, again, it reignited this, like, injustice. Whew. And I just became on fire with, like, protecting. Well, so what happened is I basically started seeing the kids as my family members. And that's really what you have to do if you want to step into that role as a teacher. I was already a dad, and that really helped, you know. But I really think that's a really important transition. You can't go in there and be like, I'm a single person. Oh, there's all these other people who are about to be single people. Because you can see those subs from, like, 100 feet away. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it's like, I went in there, and I really wanted to serve. Because I went in there reluctantly and then saw the damage and then saw the crazy things other teachers were doing, mm-hmm. thinking with their, without realizing they were revealing it with their bodies and faces. And I just felt like, holy cow, these kids aren't safe. Yeah. And I just felt like something had to be done. And so I didn't know what it was. And so I just stuck with the kids. I was like, well, I'm just going to hang out with you guys and tell you everything I know. Okay, guys. And so I just started, like, pouring information into kids. And guess what? I got so much backlash. I got banned from certain schools.
Wow.
I got so much trouble because I was teaching what I learned in boarding school, teaching what I learned at NYU to kids that were in the sixth most violent county in America, in the lowest performing and lowest paying county in America. Or no, in California for that last figure. So I just didn't understand. And at the same time, I was basically not making enough money. So I had, like, really stepped off this world, out of this world where I was valued, into a world where I was a sub. And ego-wise, right, I had to really, like, come to grips with that. But that's why I poured myself into service. And then I got into this situation with this school where they saw what I was doing. And they were like, hey, we know who you are. And I was like, yeah. And they were like, we want to hire you because you're amazing. And all the things you're teaching are exactly what we want. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm not in trouble? They're like, no. And they made me their permanent sub. And then I was their first student teacher. And it was an experimental charter school, mm-hmm. which means it's still a public school. So they still have to follow certain rules and everything. Still a standardized test and all that kind of stuff. But there's no textbooks. They had laptops, and they encouraged me to do things like no homework. And not all the teachers were doing that. Few of the teachers were doing that. But I basically trusted them and did all the things that they suggested I try and discovered crazy cool things. Like, for instance, if we go out into the woods and learn to chop wood together, that's authentic learning in a way that kids just don't get in schools. So what do I mean by that? Well, if we go and do what we do in schools, where the teacher's going to just talk to you about the idea, and then you're going to take a worksheet and fill out the missing words in the statements that she kind of rehashed in front of you, maybe you're going to see some diagrams and identify parts of the diagrams, and then answer multiple choice questions in, you know, relation to that. That's not actually going to encode into the deeper part of your understanding, your memory, or be part of your identity. Meanwhile, when you're doing things authentically, when you're doing things even kinesthetically, because authentically doesn't necessarily have to be kinesthetically, but it really deeply encodes into who they are. And so I started doing things that were student-centered. So they came from the student. I started doing things that would prompt the students to ask questions rather than me asking the questions, like the Socratic method. There's an above that method called heuristic. We were encouraged to do project-based learning. So the highest level of learning was creation and then being critical about it and improving it. So it wasn't just the essay. It was them acting out, standing and delivering, talking in front of an audience about it, answering questions about it, the highest level of learning. And so it set me on fire because it allowed me to do all the things that like I instinctually knew were right. But then it encouraged me to go further. I got my master's degree, and then I kept getting in trouble. You know, I kept saying things that got me in trouble because of the stuff I was researching and sourcing, used words and vocabulary and concepts and themes that either affected people's political ideology or their education or their ignorance or something like that. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I'm like going into debt and we're still facing cancer regularly. And so I know it's a crazy story, but we're at this point where it's like a crisis again in my life.
Yeah.
And we're in a garage. I was, you know, in New York City, I had a 2-story apartment. You know what I mean? I was doing well. We're in a garage. We're worried about the conditions of the garage, and her health as well, and our kids' health. We're cooking inside on a camping range stove at this point. We're living off credit cards off and on, even though, you know what I mean, I'm working as much as I can. And it was this crisis point. And I discovered permaculture. I'm trying tinkering organic gardening and finding it's not really working as well as I thought. The first year was magic. The second year, all the animals showed up. Most people don't realize that's how it happens. And so it was brutal. I thought I was magic first year. And then the second year, I thought I was an idiot or thought I was like, I just missed the whole boat. And so I really dug into the science. Carol Depp was really the person that led me to start studying the word permaculture because someone attributed the word permaculture to her. And then I was like, what's that? And then I found the Wallapini and the Benson Agriculture Institute, part of the Brigham Young University program. It's an academic thing. It's an outreach thing. It's humanitarian aid thing. I had read that. And so between those two things, the science, the actual, you know, like they're actually using these things, that's what propelled me to start studying the word. And then I started applying the things. And then I'm a little bit extreme, right? So I ended up reading like all the source material. So I read like Bill Mollison's works. And then I took Jeff Lawton's course with our only savings. My wife had actually secretly been saving them, but I found, you know, when it came around, I was like, whoa, this we'll never be able to afford it. And I was like, well. And it was crazy because I took it and then I was able to ask all the highest level questions, completely kind of unrelated to his PDC, because I was asking all the questions from like Bill's work. And so I was able to like really tinker at that higher level on my site. And within months applying what I had learned, I was, you know, making soils that were to my arm deep. And I was, you know, online studying other things. I was studying Sepulcher in depth, studying Fukuoka. But it was just so incredible when I started doing compost teas, what happened to the soil. And there's definitely something to the decomposed granite of the Central Valley. It can melt essentially with the right soil life consortiums. And it's absolutely incredible. In some areas it takes, you know, some seasons, but it really does work. It's amazing. So they are really rich soils. They've got a lot to offer, but most people don't realize it because the face value doesn't show you what life can do. And so I was able to like radically transform my site with permaculture in a very short period of time. And people within permaculture like immediately recognized it. And Daniel Lawton and Jeff Lawton gave me a lot of one-on-one time and feedback so that I, even though we were remote, I was able to get a lot of feedback. And then my garden exploded into like 2 acres and I started getting noticed by Baker Creek Seeds. And then I started writing it down because I realized there was no curriculum for kids. And that's what I do. Mm-hmm. I'm the guy that creates curriculum. So it only took me 2 weeks to write the permaculture student one. Wow. it was spring break. My wife went down to my grandma's to visit my mom with the boys, and I just sat and wrote it. And then Daniel Lawton, Rosemary Morrow, Dr. Lane Ingham, Jeff Lawton, Mike Ayler, and a bunch of other people reviewed it and went over it and gave me feedback. I polished it up. I did a Kickstarter. I raised money to get the same artist that did Bill Mollison's artwork and now Jeff Lawton's more recent course. All the artwork and animation in there is by the same guy. I raised money to do work with him because I wanted someone I didn't have to redo things or explain things. I wanted someone who would just do it and I wouldn't have to worry. And the wild thing was he was next door neighbors with Jeff when Daniel was growing up. So that's the connection. Mm-hmm. So I was able to basically create this book, launch it on Kickstarter. And because I was so paid so little in this county of Madera, and it's funny, teachers laugh when they tell you you're a teacher in Madera. They're like, oh dear, how are you surviving? Because they know how little you get paid. Mm-hmm. Oh, shoot, I lost the thread. What was they saying?
The income from the book and the PDC and the Kickstarter.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. So I made as much money as I make in a year after taxes and a Kickstarter in 30 days.
Wow.
And then everyone was looking at me like, why are you still here, Matt? And it was just this weird thing. And it took me a while to quit, but then I did. And then I tried to launch a physical school and it failed. And then I quickly switched it to an online school and became an online educator just out of like sheer, like, pressure moment. And ever since then, I've been living, you know, selling courses and creating courses online. Collaborating. I created after that the first peer-reviewed permaculture textbook ever, and it's the first fully cited global textbook since Bill's in 1989. And so it's really a unique work. I keep updating it because of we keep discovering new things. Like, for instance, there's bacteria that can digest wood lignin. You will not find that in most textbooks anywhere. And in my second edition, it's not there, but in my third edition, it will be. And lots of people are like, yeah, but it's one thing that they found and it's not ubiquitous, but it's important to have the caveats in there so that people don't go dogmatic. And so I really, really dig deep into the most recent research, the most recent studies and discoveries, because if you don't, you're going to have students just Googling you and proving you're wrong. I was in a classroom where that happened regularly. And you just really had to change from that guru. And this is probably why I'm different than most teachers. Mm-hmm. Facilitator. And I want to be a facilitator for greatness. And that's really where the unstoppable enthusiasm thing comes in, because enthusiasm is actually measurable and it's academic and it's studied, it's scientific in the academic world. We study it because it's actually like directly linked to engagement. Because if studying something makes you feel alive inside, it encodes so deeply into your memory and you can hold such a large bandwidth and great depth of information on that topic. That's why we've got like 10-year-old, you know, girls and boys out there that are absolute experts at certain topics. And you're like, whoa, I don't even know about that. Well, you know, because they're so passionate about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that happens in sixth and seventh grade that destroys that, though, and that's a real problem. And I do believe that there are very specific reasons for that. Number one being the way we teach, specifically science. We start by disempowering the student, being like, "Trust me, there are these atoms and electrons and molecules and stuff, and we'll show you pictures and I'll tell you about it, but you can't go and see them yourself." But if we started with microbiology, started off with skin cells and microscopes, and have the youngest of children do it themselves, proving it to themselves. Well, they're actors in their world. They're proving, they're little scientists, and they naturally are always. I mean, we're going around tasting things, right? We're always scientists, but something happens where the curiosity gets lost. And we need to keep that there. And I really truly believe that having permaculture in schools is the linchpin. I mean, it's not only the linchpin of our ethics and principles, so it guides science to actually serve people, to actually serve the future by design, but it's what keeps it interesting and exciting for children. So yeah, no, I'm totally focused on radically changing the educational experience for children because I feel like it's disempowering. I feel like they're being cheated out of an education. People talk about unschooling as if it's the opposite of what school could ever be, but that's not accurate. What I did essentially in my classroom was set up every kid with their independent educational program and like an IEP, except it wasn't like a like it wasn't a crutch. It was actually their key to unlocking themselves. And so by individualizing our educations completely and giving kids complete freedom and having our teachers be so qualified that they're comfortable in a classroom like that, because you have to be knowledgeable. You really do. We had these officials from the Netherlands come and visit our school, and they ended up in my classroom most of the day. And I was like, "What am I doing?" You know what I mean? Because they don't tell you. They're just observing. And then I like went to my principal. I was like, "Can you find out?" And he said he talked to them, and then he got them eventually to talk to me. And it was because I was comfortable with chaos, they said. And for me, it's not chaos because I know my kids. That's just their who they are. And so there's a threshold to that cognitively and heart space to a degree for most people. And so and people have the bandwidth thing because it's their understanding threshold a lot of the time. And so it's hard because you want, those teachers to get the training and the love they need. But at the same time, I'm always going to fall on the side of the kids. And so at this time period, feeling all this stuff, learning all this stuff, I suddenly began to be able to answer all those hard questions. It was being able to rise to the challenge of being in a very conservative area, coming up with very progressive ideas, ideas that could be seen as liberal. But I was able to like partner with some of the most conservative people and show people that it's nothing to do with that. This is just living here on a planet. You know what I mean? This is just like, understanding what it is to honor ourselves, each other, and the planet we live on, and the biodiversity that shares it with us. And so it just evolved from becoming, for me, this way to liberate students is the way to liberate all of our culture. And I recognized that it wasn't just this book that I created for elementary and high school, that I was creating this career path, leading people to this new economy where they could apply these skills in creating a regenerative society. So a culture where every purchase, every decision, and every action actually benefits the biodiversity, the soil, people, and the future. It's almost like the waste you create is investment in future wealth. Which, seems like far afield, but it's actually not.
Yeah, you got to close the loop. Yeah, always.
Right. In nature, it's always that way.
Yep.
And so it's been a long journey, and that's why there's a book about
Well, thanks for
it.
sharing. Yeah, go ahead.
because it's been such a long journey. And it's been this process of pressure and growth and pressure and growth and really overcoming that sense of woe is me. Why is my wife having cancer? Why have, you know, consistently I've been able to taste something that I've wanted and then it's been taken away from me. And really facing that and understanding the gifts that we have in front of us and understanding the opportunities we have in front of us has allowed me to propel into this whole movement of hope, excitement, and opportunity. And it really represents an entirely new world and way of thinking. So it's a big story. But yeah, it's been an adventure.
It is. And thank you for sharing it because there's so much there, especially, yeah, when you speak about the way that a crisis can motivate incredible, radical, personal transformation and ultimately empowerment, you know, it's just inspiring to hear. So there's some real talk in there. And so I appreciate you getting into that and sharing. And I think that informs today's conversation. On this unstoppable enthusiasm, how do you manage to be unstoppably enthusiastic?
I think the number one thing is to gently recognize your boundaries, because you can't have it all. People immediately think of enthusiasm as this energy thing, like exuberance. They get it confused with exuberance, and so they think of it as over-enthusiastic. And that's draining, and it's stoppable. Even like, it's like fervor, right? It's like there is a power there. There is a power to hysteria. But it's limited. It runs out of energy. It burns itself out. Mm-hmm. But the unstoppable place really is recognizing where our limits are and being able to pause and rest and recharge at critical moments so you can actually go further, farther, and deeper. And at the end of my book, I talk about this symbol metaphor that I've lived, my entire life I've wanted to sing, and I've always tried to sing, tried so hard, and I forced it. And you can hear my old records, you can go on iTunes and hear it, and a lot of that stuff is like teetering between forcing a voice and not having a voice. And I did all this vocal training, and even in the vocal training, I strain at times. And it's taken me years to realize that the only way that I'm going to have my true voice, and I'm really arriving on it now, you know, as I approach 40, it's this gentle building of my voice, my honest voice, my authentic voice that has no pressure and develops these patterns and systems within my muscles and my understanding of where the pitches and tones are, even the control of air and positioning of my tongue. All of it is coming out of, and much stronger coming out of, that gentle place, that protracted observation. So I would say that starting there is the most important, because if you're not getting enough sleep, if you're not drinking enough water, if you're not, you know, taking those 5 to 10 minute breaks every hour and recognizing your limitations, you're not going to be able to do the habits within those timeframes that are necessary to power you, you know, to have that extraordinary life or have that enthusiasm on tap. And it really is enthusiasm on tap, because when you are rested, when you are centered mentally, when all your thoughts are, you know, the important things you know are written down, and you don't need to worry about them because you can just refer to them. You have access to such a broader, well, you have more grip over so much of your faculties. So I'd say start there.
Okay. And then, so it's interesting, I guess relatedly, from where do you draw hope? Because I think we're going to need it in this conversation.
So people wonder, I think, why I'm so addicted to like reading, like and digest. I'm reading Just Enough right now, along with The Biggest Estate on Earth and a bunch of other things. But it's because I truly believe hope is not just faith, not just a belief on things that will be or are unseen or things like that, but I believe hope comes from work and action, actually doing the research, testing these things out, so that your faith can feed upon the actual like verifications that you take in your life. Just like, you know, being that scientist, you know, and doing the actual research, doing the actual testing. When we do that in our own lives, it really feeds that hope. So if someone is talking about soil, you know, and carbon, and they're talking about how fast you can make soil and all this stuff, and you actually go and do it, and you're like, holy cow, you know, this really does work. I mean, look how dark and rich the soil is. And we know that's directly correlated with the carbon. And it's, you know, it's you prove it to yourself. You see it, you live it. So I really believe that's a fundamental key.
Very cool. Matt, in a recent email to your mailing list, you asked the question that that I think motivated, you know, I've actually wanted to talk to you for a long time, but this was the one that really said, all right, we got to have this conversation. And that question, to which we'll return in a second, was, what will happen if your local food supply is cut off? Before we get there, though, because I know this conversation is going to be, we're going to be talking about permaculture a lot, I think any discussion we have around this answer is going to be, or needs to be, informed by and infused with the permaculture ethics. In fact, you have them right in your bio, right? Earth care, people care, future care. You're an amazing teacher. So I'm going to lean on you a little bit here and ask if you can just sort of explain those ethics a little bit. How best do you do that?
Yeah, because they dovetail with this whole conversation. Mm-hmm. Originally, I should say that the third ethic has been in permutation because I feel like they've been trying to articulate future care. I heard future care from someone suggesting it to me, and then I found out later that other people have been using it, and it was originally came out of Africa. But it also, I was explained it through a Native American indigenous perspective. But essentially, all the oldest, longest lasting cultures that were the most regenerative had these three core ethics: caring for the earth, caring for people, and then having a return of surplus, a fair share, some way to support those other two ethics. And future care really is management of those resources, that abundance, long-term investment, and long-term planning. And if you don't have those three, you know, the management, the monitoring, and the planning, and that's where community comes from. That's where, you know, governance in all its different forms comes from. That's why I have future care, because return of surplus is too economic and narrow. Fair share is too broad and political, socially complicated for some people. But they rhyme, so that's why people loved it. So for me, future care says all of those things in a way that allows me to actually think about it in actions that we can see. I mean, we understand long-term planning, long-term investment, long-term management, measurement, and monitoring. So earth care, it's pretty obvious. It's the foundation for all human civilization. Natural capital is the fundamental capital. All capital is based on natural capital. All resources are based on natural capital. This is the world we live in. If you look at history, there's a direct correlation between the areas of fertility, fertile soil, abundant natural resources, and civilization growth. So areas where they have a large population, poor soils, that's not a model for growth. And we've seen it time and time again. So people care I really feel like this in a lot of permaculture just gets pushed aside because they're like, oh, well, that's charity and we already know those things. Let's keep talking about gardening. But it really is interpersonal, and then it is the economic and governance side. And economies and governments and also education are all linked because they're how we actually create, reinforce, and then pass on our cultures. So in governance, it's just the management of culture. You know what I mean? So it could be, you know, direct democracy, decentralized, village-based council, you know what I mean? Doesn't have to just be federal, you know what I mean? What a lot of people think when they hear the word government.
Yeah, yeah.
Interpersonal, you know what I mean? It's the difference between our inner world and then our interactions between other people. And we have to have that discussion of the inner world. We don't in schools. Self-care, reflection, which is the highest level of learning, is not valued as the most important part of the process of every unit, of every section that kids are participating in schooling. So I really have brought a lot of academic stuff. I've really rewritten a lot in permaculture and changed some of the vocabulary to get it to this point where we really have it aligned to be able to, you know, handle the scrutiny of the mainstream. So I've really tweaked things and made them and reinforced them and iterated them down so that micro to macro, detail to complex, simple to complex, detailed to generalized, we can actually say, yes, that's true. Yes, that works. And get this into schools everywhere, because that's, you know, really what's holding us back is all these regenerative practices, whether they're agroforestry, permaculture, nonviolent communication, they aren't ubiquitously adopted into schooling, so they're not being adopted into our economy and our government and our cultural passing on and communication on all levels. So that's why the it's so important to have those as the foundation for all education. And that's why I'm focused on them, and that's why I've adapted them the way I have. Permaculture really is those three ethics, because out of those ethics come the principles, all the natural principles, even the social principles, which I still am the only one that has social principles for permaculture. And then I created the permaculture education standards as well, all based off of those things. And again, it's an expansion of permaculture for most people because I include all the native plants, flora and fungi and biodiversity. I mean, that's fundamental. It's like, and then because of that, that means all the indigenous histories, philosophies are also fundamental to our education, no matter where we are. So I keep expanding things and keep raising the bar in many ways. And so many people who are well familiar taking the PDC permaculture are going to hear this and go, whoa, that's bigger and broader than what I experienced. So I just wanted to put it that way. But yeah, those are the three ethics of permaculture, and that's what everything's based on. And those are actually, they form a lens. Lots of people say it's a design science, or they say it's a set of techniques. It's not. It's really those three lenses, and between those three lenses is the way nature views the world, actually. Mm-hmm. Nature's always investing. Nature's always thinking about all the basic systems of the earth. And then it's thinking about all the, you know, the biodiversity relying upon the earth. So, and we're just included in that. I mean, it really could end up being earth care and future care if we think about it long enough, because we are on the earth, you know.
That's true, yeah. No, you're exactly right. And I agree that these are important. So much flows from them. And that's why I wanted to definitely hit them here, because I think we just have to have that foundation. And I was actually going to say, yeah, in my experience, so much flows from this beyond your garden and your home and your energy flows. Like, it starts to inform your life design, right? The way you structure your time and your relationships. And it sounds like you've also found that it infects your thinking in a good way and the rest of your life.
Soil science is actually the same way. Once you start understanding that plants have consent, like they actually create relationships where they send out signals and they put out foods that create relationships with specific fungi and bacteria that they are attracted to, and then they literally let them enter their bodies in a consensual relationship that stops or starts at when they decide. This kind of consent makes conventional farming, where it's all water-soluble, salt-based fertilizers, well, that's not consent at all, because they literally slurp it up with the water. They have no ability to moderate how much they get. So that's why the MPK works so well. It just boop, and they create these plants. Meanwhile, there's no the phytochemical, you know, there's not really the kind of nutrition, the trace elements, the micronutrients, minerals, all those kind of things that we really need are missing. So, yeah. To circle back to that other question, unless I haven't answered that one.
No, go ahead.
About what if something goes wrong? Many of us have seen something go wrong. I was in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas in California, and there's only really two ways in when they're into ochre. So there's through the Mariposa and then through Fresno 41. I lived on 41, and when the fires hit, they cut off the roads. Mm-hmm. And when really big snows hit or really big rains hit, and then you have soil life, you have the soil's give. And then you have these events where trees are literally shifting into the middle of the road with their root ball and like taking up the whole road, and rocks are falling into the road. So we regularly got cut off. And within a few days, the town would be out of food in the grocery stores. People would be out of power and starving after 5-6 days. It got really crazy. And it was like, I heard about it because I'm the high school teacher, you know, the English teacher, sophomore. So I'm hearing everything. And it's like, whoa. And as part of, you know, my church, we were recommended to have 72-hour kits, kind of like a bug-out kit, you know what I mean, thing. And then having 2 to 3 months of food minimally, if not a food storage of 2 years. And so, like, we're already thinking this way. And then seeing our communities have these climate shocks, having these systemic, I call them hiccups. Hiccups are going to increasingly come. We can see them happening in other countries, like in Africa, where climate shocks are happening one on top of the other. Societies are not able to react, and so they start breaking down, and you have civil wars, and the women and the children are exploited first. So we're seeing that in our society. We're seeing that our women and our children aren't being protected. And that's like the first step, right? There's lead in the water. There's PCBs and you know, in the soils. And, you know, all these different things are there's contaminants everywhere. There's Roundup, like, everywhere. And so we have to face the reality that hiccups will come, that if we are just eating food storage food over a long enough time period, we're going to have health challenges. Yep. Just be honest. I mean, come on, eating dried foods, dried goods, you're going to have health challenges. And even, you know, you can go, you can stretch it. You can be doing things like we've got, spirulina in bulk, and we've got different things like, you know, super nutritious things, but you need that fresh food. You need those enzymes. Mm-hmm. You need all that good stuff. So I realized, you know, very early on that your seed bank, well, that's there's the seed bank. I've got a whole, you know, tote, you know, the big black and yellow top totes full, like, I'm not going to move things around, but it's full of seeds. And I realized that was so incredibly important, because if you study history, and I know you do, there are years where it rained for that year and the next. Mm-hmm. You didn't plant crops and you didn't get anything. they just starved, and people ate grass and like boiled bark and like, yeah. So this is that like, that's how like people discover, you know, new foods, you know what I mean? They start eating the weeds and they're like, hey, this is pretty good. You know what I mean? So I don't want people to get to that point. Luckily we have some foraging classes, you know, people like Jason Padbrack, and other people that like are just people all around, all over the, our areas that are actually experts in that. But I realized having not just an annual garden, having the food forest, having the native food forest, even, especially as the ring around that, protecting your inner food forest, that's the most critical in my mind. If you're gonna do a food forest, be sure you line it with a native food forest, because that's where the animals come and the pollinators come. And that's where like the real exchanges are actually happening, because they're going to come and interact with that instead of destroying your other stuff, because they're like, your other stuff, not natural. You know what I mean? So yeah, I would always say do that. But that's where the resiliency is going to come from. Having that four seasons of food, and maybe that fourth season, it's a combination of you digging up the sunchokes underneath the snow. It's that, you know, that root cellar of food where it's in that hibernation stage in the sand. You got your carrots in the sand. So they're alive, but they're in storage still. And you're really, you know, fermenting your food. So you're unlocking those minerals and nutrition. So in those winter months, you're really getting those things that are hard to get from the dry food storage. So
Let me pause you for 1 second, yeah, because we're chipping away now at the question, and I just want to make sure, I want to let people in on what that question was. So I had mentioned that, yeah, that you had posed the question in a recent newsletter message, what will happen when your local food supply is cut off? And specifically, Matt, you wrote, you know, the U.S. Midwest is not going to recover soon from this winter's storms and the flooding and the livestock losses. The Australian drought is beyond compare. Crop failures and food shortages are certain, and food prices are going to skyrocket, close quote. Suffice to say, Matt, that my viewers and I largely agree with your assessment there, and the implications of that kind of a threat to modern agriculture and in turn to our food supply, it's not an entirely comfortable line of thinking, right? It's not terribly fun to think or talk about or to even act on. It starts to sound like doom and gloom. Some people won't even go there. But that's why today we're armed with our unstoppable enthusiasm. And so the question is exactly that. How does one respond to these myriad threats to our food security with unstoppable enthusiasm?
Absolutely. So I really believe it goes back to the education aspect, where when we are informed, we can rely upon that, have trust in the principles and the systems of the natural world. And because we've actually done them and participated in them, we know they can scale. It's like having that food forest, having that seed bank, and knowing you have enough seeds that you can actually, like, I know that I could feed dozens of families, like 100% cover their food, because of how many seeds I have. And that's why I want to get it all on the ground and then amp it up so that I can feed hundreds of families completely, not just give thousands of families a cute little garden. So I really do believe that we have the opportunity to approach this with not only the right attitude, but with excitement, knowing that we're actually reversing all the problems that we've caused. We're actually stepping into a hero's role, where we are saving seeds, not just for ourselves, we're saving seeds for our community. We are not just, you know, creating soil on our site, we're actually sequestering carbon. We're actually, when we're soaking in on all that water, that's actually the greatest greenhouse gas when it's in vapor. 90% of the effect is caused by water vapor. So, you know, getting that water in the ground, you know, all these different things, you're actually helping everything. You are doing the right things. It feels great. You can verify it. Those things feed you in such an immediate way. There's such quick wins when you no longer are having the garbage can go out every week, and suddenly it's every 2 weeks, or suddenly it's once a month. And you instead see it becoming that fertility that we talked about. Instead of it becoming something you're paying for, it's something that's feeding you, something that's protecting your children and your wife. So I really do believe that when we step into these roles of service, when we step into these roles of higher performance, of doing the things that we thought weren't even possible to a degree, we unlock this like confidence and competence and empowerment, really, that gives us this electric bounce and makes us feel alive. And not only does, you know, doing these things, being physical, always is going to bring a different state, because you can't do like jumping jacks, jump up and down and yell really loud and feel low energy and depressed. We actually, it cues our body into a different state. And the same thing happens when you're touching the earth. Mm-hmm. Yes, there is that microbiological exchange. There's all these wonderful things in soil, but it's also you're doing these natural acts that your body, you have an ancient body, we all do. And it reacts and to the congruency of what we're doing. And so it's really about doing these things that are congruent, that unlock that enthusiasm, and that enthusiasm really is just what makes us feel most alive. And so it's the action, it's the thinking as well, because you begin to realize that all the things we've been told that are limiting stories about ourselves and the world around us aren't true. You start seeing amazing things happen in nature. And then the more you study it, you're like, oh, wait, so the thing that was 5 years ago that was the truth, mm-hmm. is now, you know, not the truth.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more complicated and a little bit really cool. You just start having this faith in the unknown, in what is possible, in how you are possible. And I really do believe that when we study these things, that's really where it comes from. And so having that knowledge, having that life learning, daily learning, is really why I'm always adding to my courses and updating things. I mean, even this morning, I was adding to the third edition of my book, The Permaculture Student 2, because of a conversation I had yesterday with author and professor David R. Montgomery of the most incredible book, Dirt, Erosion of Civilizations, as well as Growing a Revolution and the Hidden Half of Nature. So there's just so much to learn. And when there's so much to learn, you feel like you can't be certain about your depressing thoughts, your fear, your anxiety. It's like you poke holes in it with your education and all this hope and this cool, curious kind of stuff, and the power of nature and the power and possibility of our role in nature. Because the reality is, humans are the greatest force on earth for regeneration or for degeneration. So understanding that, stepping into that role, doing the actions, really allows us to have that enthusiasm. And it's really surprisingly easy. So just starting off with, you know, buying seed in bulk is pretty darn easy. You know, you can do that. You can also get food storage in bulk through Azure Standard. You can get it organic for nearly the same price as emergency preparedness people, the beprepared.com folk. And so Yeah, I really do believe that the way to have enthusiasm when it comes to all this stuff, because it's true, it's real. And the reality is, if you panic, if you get scared, if you let fear underneath your lid, you are literally shutting down the most important parts of your brain that allow you to be compassionate, that allow you to be sensitive to other people, calming the people in your life that you need to help you get these things done in a timely fashion so that they don't actually become dangerous. And so it's like, if we want to get over that wall, we can't be hysterically yelling at the person next to us. We actually have to be the voice of reason. We have to be calm, clear, and action-oriented. Because enthusiasm really is a mix of faith, anticipation, excitement, and it ties right into hope, because that anticipation and faith together create hope. So it's this brilliant mix that allows us to access our best states. And when we can really be in that place, and I know this because of educational research. So when we are actually enthusiastic, when we're feeling alive, when we're open, we're feeling comfortable and safe, we actually can go to the deepest parts of our brain, encode things, and remember things at such a deep level. So I fundamentally understand that that's the problem with the environmentalist movement. Is they're like, and everyone's like, brain shut down. And they're either defensive, or they're scared,
yeah,
or they feel guilty. You know, like there's all these like things that are shutting down their brain. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, if I want to get a result here, I have to do these things really strategically. So if I touch upon the problem, I have to quickly follow the solution that's empowering. And so I fundamentally realized this a long time ago. And so I've always been trying to bring that hope and enthusiasm as I teach, as I create these pathways so that they are empowering, so that they are actually used. I really feel that when we talk about these things, it's incredibly important to really take hold of our emotions and to maybe sit through our emotions and meditate, you know, on why we feel upset, afraid, or scared, and write them down and talk through each of them. Because I've done this. Most of us who have those kinds of things have done this. And then work through them, because when you bring those fears embedded in you, people pick them out. Mm-hmm. And that's when like you're writing something and someone says something and you're like, and it like burns and you're like, and you're like defensive, but you know they're parsed right deep down inside it, it burns. And so we just really need to do the work beforehand so that we have no doubts, or we understand our doubts, because our doubts are asking questions. And so we do more research because of those doubts. And we're like, well, actually it is true. We really can't, you know, just put solar panels all over the place and get, you know, there tomorrow.
Right.
And you know what I mean? And doing those work, that work, and facing our fears, facing our doubts, really allows us to have control over those things so that we can really cue what we care about and communicate it without all that baggage that will hold that message back and will make it so that you actually don't get those people to take action. They may even believe you, but because you've got that worm of doubt or that hesitation, they believe you with the hesitation.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. And you're also right. When we go into that fear mindset and you activate the fear, the flight or fight pathways, and you shut down that whole frontal lobe, your parasympathetic system kicks in, your cortisol levels go through the roof. You can't think anymore at that point. You're definitely not going to create abundance at that point. Okay. So you said stressing the importance of complementing when you deliver some of these threats, some of these less exciting things to think about, with the knowledge. So give us more of a taste of that knowledge.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just start with a really basic, easy one. So seeds, the reality is you effortlessly can grow the best seeds in the world for you. And it happens very close to home, happens in your backyard or your garden. And it's the most incredible thing, because the seeds we buy are being grown in areas that the seeds are easy to grow. And they usually aren't like where we live. most of us who are gardening in marginal spaces because the really prime, you know, agricultural land is already used or was destroyed and his house is built on it now.
Absolutely. You did a video about, you know, the orange giant golden amaranth, which is just, it's just such a joy to watch you as you harvest that and save some of those seeds. And actually, you know, I received the, yeah, it's amazing. That is, so you sent me a package of that and I will confide with you that it was like, I was like a kid on Christmas morning when I got that pack of seeds because I was sitting there with my 5-year-old and taking them out and just saying, look, this is wealth. This is true wealth right here because you can't buy these seeds. These seeds already want to live here. They've already lived here, in fact, and they're happy to be here and you can't get those anywhere else. So it was a real special moment for both of us, and for him to, I think, see me get that excited about something was already just sort of fun. But yeah, that's, I really enjoyed you hearing. Talk more about the land races.
Yeah. So let's get into that. So I've actually got a fun land race here that I have made more of a land race out of. So this right here started off as painted mountain flower corn. And this is a short habit corn. It's like 4 to 6 feet tall, 2 to 3 ears per stalk. And it's flower corn. So it's really digestible. If I was to take a rock and something and tap them, they would explode and turn into powder. So instead of breaking up into fragments that are hard and make grit, they make flour, which is totally different than almost everyone's experience. Some people look at this and go, is that Indian corn? Well, the reality is this is actually a combination of corn that was combined to get a bunch of different, almost all the different colors of flower corn are in here. And I've added to it. So I've added Chinmark to it. I've added some amazing Peruvian speckles, purple, and then mottling as well to it, as well as like these kiss marks that I've never seen on anything else. It's almost like they've been kissed on the top with like hot pink. And basically a land race is a combination of different heirlooms. It's actually where we get heirlooms. So there's big ones, short ones, different colored ones, and they range the gamut in behavior. So some like it wet, some like it dry. So every year you have winners. And this is how all of us originally farmed, was using land races or adapted wild plants. So this is where all the variation came from. And so this is where we actually can return to regenerate and create a resiliency. So for me, what I regularly do is I'll just get like 12 different kinds of kale and grow them all next to each other and let them cross-pollinate. And everyone's like, oh, you lost the... I did? No. I actually combined all the genes and expanded their vocabulary. It's actually not like you lost those and you lost this. That does happen. But when you're doing it in a land race and saving all the seed, you are literally creating this just lexicon of genetics. And just how every sequence has 30,000 expressions in it, that's the epigenetic switch that determines that. Not the actual sequence, that's why GMOs are really problematic, because they don't address the epigenetic expressions. When you add in more genetic expressions and availability, they actually can respond to the environment with much more elegance, much more alacrity. And so you get these really intelligent plants. And you go to, you know, into these areas where people are doing this and you're like, your plants are crazy. And like that amaranth video, people freak out. It's, you know, my most popular video of me gardening because they're like way above me, like crazy higher above me. And I have not seen other people with amaranth plants that big. And it's because I grew them there again and again and again, and they learned that place really, really well. So Land races are incredibly important because they're bioregional seed collections of genetics that allows them to be extraordinarily resilient, but then on top of that, extraordinarily adaptable and flexible in their environment. And so you would start with, you know, harvesting like everyone so that you're getting all those genetics in there. And with the understanding that that whole saving seed from the best plants in the worst soil is not going to be that revealed in the first season, right? They're figuring it out. They're reacting. What you're seeing is the expression of the last place they were. So it's like that seed where they crosses that melon and that squash, and it's fine that first season, but the seeds inside it are crosses. It's the same thing when we grow them out. That first season, they're just reacting. Mm-hmm. So I had these carrots that just kept bolting, and I just let them go to seed. And within 2 to 3 years, I was getting long carrots that are thick and sweet. But it's because I was like, well, white carrots, I'll let you figure it out. I'm not going to get rid of them. I'm not going to say you're bad or evil.
And that
bad carrot, you can't live here.
That's right. Most people will just give up on it. They say, oh, I guess I can't grow this variety. But you have a patience with them.
Well, because I understood that there's a genetic progression happening. The seeds are really just students of the bioregion. And when we adopt these seeds and bring them onto our homestead and into our soils, we really need to have that understanding that they need to learn and understand and grow and progress. And where they're coming from is so different. So that whole thing, we need to give them time, and then we need to move into selection. So we let them express, we let them, and also part of the expression is volume. But volume is so incredibly important. There's a reason why, you know, this is one of the years, and I keep the years separate in seed saving. But when you go up to volume and scale, you end up creating incredible things. So when I went to volume and went over 1,000 plants with the amaranth, albino amaranth showed up. Mm-hmm. And I call it albino because it lacks the pigment. So it's lime green and white. And so it's like, it just looks so different because so many of the amaranth, they're like purple and pink and orange. But this is totally new. And so I saw this and I was like, holy cow. And then I also noticed that my stalks, which were in some cases this thick around, for a teeny seed that big to go this thick around, just absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
People hadn't seen this. And so people were just freaked out. They're like, how are you even doing this? What the heck's going on? And so I crossed it with other giant amaranths, like the red giant amaranth, and then pulled all and chopped and dropped, really. Not pulled, but just didn't use those seeds. You know what I mean? I made sure to pull those seeds before they got into the seed bank, before they continued. So, and they're still throwbacks. I'll get skinny little reds and chop those down before they get in the seed bank. But they're almost always the amaranth grows and falls over. And so I've been selecting for that stronger stock, that thicker stock. And so really, it's about being really observant and then partnering with the adaptation process and using our ability to select from the best plants in the worst conditions. Some people say, you know, I've said in the past the worst soils, but the worst conditions, because it might be the area that you didn't water that year. You know, it could be great soil, but heck, no water. You know, so it's the worst conditions. And those are the people that I call them people, plant people, that are under the most extreme pressure. And those are the people that are rising up. Those are our heroes. And so you see incredible things happen. Like when I did this amaranth in an area where we didn't water at all, we just did rain. I planted with the rain. It was where a burn pile was. So, but we didn't burn there, so it wasn't like we killed all the phosphorus. It just was an area that was cleared of vegetation. And so it grew and then did just really fascinating things. First of all, it grew and then maintained green leaves through the summer. No, and it's 112 degrees, 140 degrees soils. And then it resprouted in September when the dews started hitting harder again. Mm-hmm. So wild. And then the seeds that came from those plants were black. So they went back in time and protected themselves from the UVs, thinking like, we're going to have to survive in this heat, exposed on the surface, because I had surface sown them traditionally. So they had understood that they were expected to sprout from the surface. So they created their protective layer. It's just absolutely incredible what they're actually doing and can do and express to us. So that's what I would say with seeds, as a really good first step towards becoming more resilient, diving into, having that protection, that seed bank that is resilient, that it will face climate shocks. And then having that living seed bank, having that living food bank where it's the trees themselves, it's the roots, you know, so that like in the winter you can dig things up and get at them, or, you know, you can store that fruit or nut all over the course of the winter. Depending on where you are in your area, you probably could do just fine with doing some winter crops.
Fantastic answer. And I just want to stress also that these things happen more quickly than one might think when you hear these kinds of things. Oh, it's going to take me years to get this thing. But you shared in your video about the corn that while in the first season you were sort of barely able to eke out the crop during your growing season, but you did, and you were able to save some. That next year, you mentioned there's a whole month faster that they actually came to yield, and that's just amazing. I just wanted, anything else on that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you're referencing the Peruvian corn land races that I got to work with. So one year, they're cleaning up at the Heirloom Expo in California, and Jer and I are talking about seeds, and I was showing him the adaptation to that, and he gave me all the seeds on the table. And so that's really why I got to play so much with these things. And because I had so much germplasm, because I was doing all these things, I got educated on it all, a lot more from experts. And that's why I'm written up in books about it. But what essentially happened was a corn that was considered impossible to grow in North America by the experts on this corn, Piscorrontu and Cuyuchispi corn from island valleys of Peru. So this is 7,000 to 9,000 feet range is where these corns are grown. Incredibly different usage of water. So they're regular sized corn there, but you bring them to America and they're like, the lights are screwed up, the water is screwed up, what's going on? And they end up growing 16 to 24 feet tall. They're monsters. Wow. And they're free. And they freak out. So you'll get crowns on top, a ring of corn on top, 16 feet up. And yeah, and so I applied permaculture and I grew on basically like a sundial. So the sun rose over here and the sun set over here, and I planted over here. So there was this tree above it. So there was always dappled shade and diffuse light and only a few hours of actual direct sunlight. But it's so hot in California that it got enough energy, and I figured it was joules, not actual hours and time. So I was like, well, I'm gonna have less light directly, but more light diffused, but less joules of energy, essentially, you know what I mean, over time, if we want to measure it down to something like that. And so I was like, okay, let's see what this does. And so I did, and it worked amazingly. I was the first person to get ears. I was the first person to get seed that actually was viable. And I was getting crazy ears. It wasn't like little stubs. I was getting, you know, ears like this that had the grenade shape still in them, that had the hook-shaped, you know, points that were sharp. Like, we had, like, all this crazy variation. We had certain cobs where they were fingered cobs. In other words, there was like four cobs around a central cob inside the husk.
Wow.
So you open it up and it's like alien. You know what I mean? It's like a totally, totally freakish thing. And so I adapted it. And then the first year, I mean, I literally was the rains were coming and I was cutting down green plants, giant plants, and then cutting them to a length that I could actually stack them and put them upside down. This is a corn trick from old corn growers. And you put them upside down, still unwrapped in their husks. So all the nutrition from that corn actually flows down into the cobs, and the cobs continue to grow. So I say that it was in December, but it's actually even longer that the cobs had to keep growing. So they finished properly with the proper nutrition, properly dried down. And then the next year, my father-in-law finished up that crop, and it was a full 30 days before we even pulled it the year before. So it was 30 days difference, but it was even more so development-wise. And that's a really good trick for anyone wanting to really save some corn, but dealing with some issues. And, you know, I mean, this isn't hard. I literally took one of those short-pronged rakes, you know what I mean? The long rakes like that. And I just put it on its butt so that the rake was up top. And I stuck the corn stalks in it upside down so that they were all just hanging down. And it was this giant sheet. And I could take that thing and then hook it up high on something. And so it's not that hard. We all can do it. But no one had done it. And so it was like this big controversial thing. Everyone wanted to see the corn. But it was because I listened to the corn. I applied logic. I studied a ton. And because no one had actually told me that it was impossible. Baker Creek was selling the seeds for people to grow. And I only found out later that it was considered impossible. And then I found out later that no one had actually been able to successfully grow them. So it was really cool when I was able to grow them and then send them out to my students and have them actually grow them all over America. So I'm really excited. Also, I had their genetics show up on these. So I had something like, there it is. I have so much corn here, I had to get past the Mexican corn. But see this corn right here? It looks like it's black, but it's actually such dark, dark purple. And that didn't come from Painted Mountain flower corn. That is actually, and I wasn't growing purple corn from any other source. So these are Peruvian genetics that are inside, just like with that squash that gets crushed, just like with that plant that's adapting, there's a wider vocabulary that doesn't come out until you go to 1,000 plants, 5,000 plants. And everyone's like, what? That's crazy. Well, actually, if you're planting the way I plant, where you're throw sowing, where you're throwing in mixes, where you're creating this abundance where every square inch is covered with plants, basically, you actually find out a bunch of different things. You can grow an enormous amount of plants in a small area, and weird things happen. Everyone's like, oh no, when you crowd plants, Matt, they'll fight over resources. Well, what happens when they do fight over resources and there's all these skinny little ones and then there's this giant amaranth? What's this guy doing? So it's like, it literally is like what we're all afraid of in gardening is what we need to embrace, because it will literally destroy all of our fears and get us like propelled into doing all this other stuff. So I really think that being prepared is hypercritical. And with seeds, it's so easy. I have the original packet of seeds for my amaranth. I have seed left that I can just restart and do it again next year and get another barrel full of seed. I've sold so much seed. I've given away ridiculous amounts of seed because scaling up growing food is absolutely ridiculously easy. Humans would not have survived. We just would not have survived if that wasn't the case. So It's the linchpin. Seeds are the linchpin. It's easy to get these like gritty, resilient, amazing seeds if you treat them right and if you let them express themselves. And so I really believe that's like a linchpin in all this. And then you have the fact that the food is the best food in the world.
Yeah.
Like it's hysterical how good your lettuce can be compared to anything you've ever tasted. It's just crazy how good your tomatoes can be. And it gets to the point where you can't stand the woody nature of a carrot from a store. And you're like, well, my carrots are soft. I bite them and they're just soft and sweet. And so your enthusiasm is reinforced again by that knowledge, that confirmation that's like deep within you. And I also believe that there is something to this whole connection between the microbiology. And I know that there's, of course, the connection of health. And there's the soil microbiology and our gut microbiology. They're like mirrors in a whole cycle together. But I do believe that there's a lot to this. I mean, I've read research and studies where people are suggesting that we're influenced like hormonally and thus emotionally by the microbiome. And so people with like candida, they're like having these crazy, well, we all have candida, but candida like overgrowth,
balance, yeah.
They're craving like sugars and breads and stuff. And it's because it's directly related to that thing that's inside of them. And in like realizing that really kind of like changes our relationship, I think, because what happens is you start craving those things from the soil, you start craving those foods, and you start making weird leaps and decisions, and you have these just leaps of logic, and people are like, wait, you put kefir grains in your compost tea? And then I tell a researcher, and they're like, oh yeah, that's good stuff. Let me tell you what that's gonna do. And I'm like, I just did it because I just thought that, you know, good for me, good for them. And I had these excess grains. But it's like, was I influenced by the fact that I'm drinking the kefir every day and they're definitely living inside me,
mm-hmm.
influencing my patterns? And I don't know. But what is clear is that there are all these relationships that come out of this, and even confidence. And that comes out of this relationship with our growing our own food.
Mm-hmm.
And when it is so unique, it becomes part of our identity. So, I mean, people associate the orange giant amaranth with me, particularly because it's not even being grown or sold by Baker Creek anymore. People associate the guasantle with me because Baker Creek used to sell it and it was all mine. I was like the future grower for that. And it's because I've been able to really eat them, live them, grow them, and they are a part of my personality. Like, no one has this anywhere in the world. And that creates a very unique enthusiasm, because enthusiasm really is what makes us feel alive. And so that's what is true to our deepest core, to our deepest selves. And so when we do this stuff and we practice it in a landscape and we end up creating these things in partnership with nature, we are literally expanding ourselves and our definition of self. We are creators. We are participating in the creation of new life. And creation is where it's at. It is the highest level of learning and expression for all human beings. Why do we take so much pride in the things we build, in our children? It's because, and you know, why are we so focused on fertility? You know what I mean? And soil and all these different things and our productivity. It all goes back to the same thing, that we are focused on creation. And that's why, you know, our gods are creators. And so when we are partnering with nature, when we are partnering with creation, it really expands ourselves and allows us to participate also in something all of our ancestors participated in. And was key to who they were as identity too. And as we know from epigenetics, is still in us.
It very much so, yeah. It's unavoidable. You are what you eat is more true than a lot of people might think. And yeah, food as part of the self is a huge topic. Actually, I'd love to, maybe we'll have to have another conversation to get into that, because it's a huge topic. I think there is, you know, a lot to, it informs our culture. It's so much a part of the way we live. And, you know, when you look at GMOs and the things like the fake meat, I think there's, you know, I don't want to, yeah, there's an attack on who we are and the way we've been. So I think this is a huge topic. Can I briefly ask you, because you've mentioned Throso, and I just want to make sure people have a good understanding. You said you're just surface seeding, and then do you mulch, or what does that look like?
Yeah. So, you can't do it with all seeds, for various reasons. Some seeds actually can't create the root to go tunnel down in.
The corn.
And you may have seen, like, your tomato seeds sometimes do this, where it'll corkscrew with the root on the surface, and it'll have missed the surface entirely. So you can train. I've trained cherry tomato seeds. Most people see them pop back up the next year pretty easily. But I tend to throw seeds because it automatically chooses the most vigorous. So you're only going to get the most ambitious, vigorous seeds that will take root and take off. And then you're also training them to self-seed, so that the next year when they release seed, or I chop and drop, or whatever happens, they can figure it out and grow again. And so I choose the winners, and, well, I only see the winners, right? And so naturally the winners are chosen, and then it starts to perpetuate itself. So I do certain things, direct seeding. I try as much as possible to throw so. And then throw so, if you're on a black surface and you're throwing seed down and the birds see you, and it's something they know to eat, they're going to just come and eat it. So there's a few different things you do. A lot of people like straw because the albedo, the white reflection, the light reflection is so high that it's actually totally confusing to look at from above, because suddenly the contrast is so great that the seeds, if they're darker, are blending more into the soil and whatnot. So that's really great. So I tend to do mulch, but I really prefer interplanting essentially. So I'm like chopping and dropping, throw sowing the seeds, maybe before, maybe after, depending on the situation and the permeability. Because realistically, I mean, your seeds must touch soil. There are very few plants that actually can, you know, travel through mulch with their roots and get to the soil and then establish that relationship. There are trees, you know, tree roots, you know, that are primary root that can do that. But for annuals primarily, that's not the case at all. So you're going to want to, you know, harrow or clear the surface or disturb the surface enough that contact can be made. And then I really love chopping and dropping weeds and using them for mulch. They're there, they're free, they're fancy free, and they're usually lighter than straw. Grass, I mean, in a mat grass thing, you're going to have a situation where it's composting, it's bringing in sow and pill bugs. But in the heat where you are, where I was, you can chop those grasses and then come back that afternoon and they are dried down perfectly. And so they're this perfect super light mulch. They get pushed out of the way. Sunlight does pass through them. So the seeds know to get triggered to germinate. I would say that Throso really requires some connection, protection, and observation. So you go out there, you make sure those seeds, I mean, I've got chickens, and so I'm going out there and I'm trying to observe the damage to the extent that the chickens are doing and what they're eating and what they're not out there. And so, like, there's a lot of radishes out there. It looks like they're going after the worms, not the radishes and not the fava beans. But it's really key to do that, to get out there and really to be able to track all those aspects.
Awesome. What else? So we talk about the seeds a lot and biodiversity. What else should we talk about in terms of radically empowering people and feeding hope and people?
Yeah. I would say that the number one thing when it comes to combating the story of the world that we face right now is to get plugged into the education that will give you the skills to build your hope and your resiliency. But also just get active. I mean, maybe today is the day you sign up for Azure Standard and you order wheat berries, you know what I mean? Or some other whole grain that you'll grind yourself in an emergency. So you can store that for 10 years, you know what I mean? Because they're the berries, they're the whole thing. Maybe it's einkorn berries like we have, you know, because the ancient grain we like. But maybe it's you going out and getting three staple crops in bulk. It's actually not that much money when you get down to it, buying a giant bag of seed and having that understanding that, man, if all goes wrong, I can sprout these. Like, for instance, radishes, like brassicas, they literally are the survival crop in many ways. So they're the crop that shows up most predominantly in the hunger gap, which is the end of the winter before the early spring really takes off. It's the hunger gap. And so it's kale, hunger gap kale. There's, you know what I mean? There's lots of things that kind of fit into that space. But I would be looking at turnips, radishes, because you can eat those as sprouts. I would be getting your water situation worked out. And that's just like basic. You might have plenty of water and whatnot. And be like, well, we have excess water over here. We need food. But realistically, the main issue that's going to be happening is we're going to have extreme droughts after these flooding events. And we've seen this happen in other water cycles throughout history, where the rain, instead of being spread out, starts becoming more and more violent as it becomes more concentrated throughout the year. Mm-hmm. So you get end up having a monsoon and then a drought in this like wonky cycle. And so we really want to reverse that, but also have the understanding that that might be what we will be facing. So I would totally take those steps, start your food storage, start your seed bank, and look at your winners. I mean, it might be nice to have that, you know, that persimmon tree, but you might want to buy the mulberry tree first because you might get more fruit faster. Faster growth, more shape. You know what I mean? You're going to get those things sooner that you actually are designing. You might get the Iranian, you know, dwarf shrubby one so that you get it even faster. You know what I mean? But cane fruit. You know, you might be buying blackberries in the Pacific Northwest because you really want that food quick. So I really would say take action, take tangible action, and go into the more bulk or massive action, as like Tony Robbins would say. I really would do that. And if you aren't able to, if you're like, Matt, I'm in the position where you were, where you have only the first packet of seed from Baker Creek, you know, you're only there, but you know what? In one season, you could have cups. In two seasons, you could have so much more. And I honestly feel like it's really imperative that we do things like amaranth, because they're an eat-all green. Hosantle is an eat-all green. You can have the grains to make flour. You can eat the seeds like a porridge. You can eat the leaves. You can eat the microgreens. Those kind of plants are the kind of plants that are going to save us in those crisis time periods. So I would say doing that for starters would be really the best way to take the first steps to preparing for these food prices to skyrocket.
First steps is a great question. And I was going to ask that. I can also ask, because I'll know a lot of our viewers are in more urban settings. So what do you recommend for first steps for folks that are there? Some things I talk about are, you know, to your point of do what you can, start taking action, do what you can where you are. So I talk about, you know, mushroom logs under your bed, microgreens in the closet, farming grasshoppers, and then turning around and selling grasshoppers to people, crickets, that to people that have lizards. So you can actually start growing food where you are and actually build your income so that you open up these new futures. But what thoughts do you have?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that fungi is that, I mean, you can do it inside, you can do it in the dark, you know, some of them need light, but you can put it in a light, you can do it in the closet. I think fungi is really huge untapped potential for the urban setting. I think that there's also this whole thing with like spirulina, where we could be growing things, we'd be growing algae, we can be getting really high nutrition from something that we normally wouldn't think about as growing food. Just having a tank, in your kitchen with spirulina growing in it, or several tanks. But I would say that aquaponics as well, where you're having fish and you're being able to grow them in a system. And you can do that in systems without having to rely upon tons of plastic and PVC. There are clever ways. I mean, just think about it as stacking functions. You can have aquariums where you are just having the water go from one to the other. It could be using metal. It could be using glass. Doesn't have to just be PVC piping, which is what we normally see almost everywhere. Mm-hmm. So aquaponics can be done. And that could be a soil-based aquaponics that doesn't have to be like that hydroponics rootless or clay ball kind of thing. And then I really, really think that there is just a lot of building up that needs to happen in the city where we need to take those resources and start making soil and then putting planters on top of things, because there's concrete everywhere. You know what I mean? So we need to, and we can't just remove the concrete. I know people are like, just rip up the concrete. But the reality is, you know, how deep are we going to have to go? New York City, there are areas of Chinatown that are 10 stories above the actual soil. So it's like, you're not going to be able to reach that soil and grow in it. So I definitely think that there's a lot we can do, a lot that needs to be done. And it is hard, and we have to be really creative in the city, and think outside of the box. But just for starters, for today, I would start composting with EM and doing bokashi, if I was in an urban setting. It's just too easy, you know what I mean? And it's just so rewarding.
Great answer. And yeah, actually, between aquaponics and spirulina, you're totally speaking my language. I started my channel when I was still in the city and have some videos on feeding your algae tank, doing the filtering, all that good stuff. It's fun. Okay, let's return, because it's a big question when we look at food scarcity. So I want to make sure we feel like we've answered it well. Anything else you want to mention there? And it doesn't even have to be about food production. How do we build resiliency in a more grand sense, do you think?
By improving the nutritional density of the actual food.
Okay.
So that we have this problem where we have tons of food, but the food doesn't nourish us. And many of us know the situation where we eat a pizza and we eat like a whole pizza, and then like an hour later, we're like starving. We're like, what's happened? And it's because there's nothing in it. And people are like, oh, bread, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's like, American bread is missing the fundamental components of bread. We have made it so that will last forever, but we've actually made it so that it doesn't actually feed us and is no longer the quote staff of life. And that's why people go to Europe and they're like, the bread in France is amazing. I don't want to go home. And it's because their bread actually has all the components.
Very cool. All right. In your email, you also asked the question straight up, are you prepared? And so I want to know, what does preparedness look like to Matt Powers? And does a lens of off-grid preparedness, self-sufficiency, does that change the approach to, you know, creating a design for your home or just your thoughts?
Yeah. So I am in the middle of moving right now. So I have things that like I want to set up, but I haven't set up. So when I mention these things, people might be like, "Hey, I haven't seen that yet on your channel. Do that." So I'm going to do it, but I've got a biodigester. So I can create energy from the biogas in the generator. You have to change the size because the natural gas filters on the generators that people have are a different size, molecule size than the biogas. But I have the ability to generate electricity, to do cooking, and to create heat with this biodigester. So that's one layer. I have little, like most people, I have got like a lot of these little like solar panel doodads. You know what I mean? They can charge this, they can charge that, and they're all at like a threshold. I have a generator because we've lost power up to 6 days, and our power is our water, so we lose water. So it's incredibly important that we have water stored for us. So water storage is always a must. Got like water in the hall right now, just stacked there. And then, realistically, having gas, tanks of gas, and having a generator so that like no matter what happens, I can run the fridge for periods of time, because then you can leave the fridge for like 4 hours after it's gotten to temp. And then restart it. You know, there's like lots of like things that we have. I also have the Enki stoves, which would allow us to cook off grid, clean burning, so that we could both make biochar and clean burn without any electricity other than the solar panel connected to a fan. So I have the way to basically, if everything goes really wrong, to have a wiggle room as a setup and transition to these other modalities that I have as backup. And they aren't perfect. Obviously, we would love to have a rocket stove kitchen so that it is just like that clean burning mini stove that I have, the Enki stove, but stationary, big, and usable, and permanent, and just like a regular kitchen, except it's a little bit, you know, different here and there. But I am at that portable stage because I'm a renter still. Most of us are. And so I've got a lot of the little portable things that are meant to handle our waste, meant to generate energy, specifically like heat and electricity. And then I've got a giant seed bank so that I can not only provide for my family, but I can provide for several other families so that they would like it, so that I could use that as a bargaining chip and leverage mm-hmm. in situations. Mm-hmm. And then I've got a lot of know-how and understanding that I can bring to the table in those kind of situations as well. And so I also have books. So, for instance, most of the books are actually put away right now, but I have books, Pacific Northwest Wild Plants, ethnobotany books on indigenous peoples, the fiber usages, the like fire thing, like I mean, all the different things that I can that are survivalist, off-grid, indigenous. Because the reality is, you know, those sometimes are the quickest wins and the most correct pathways for a permacultural solution. And they may be coming from hunters. They may be coming from ecologists and or geomorphologists like David R. Montgomery. But I'm definitely always trying to gather all that in to get a really resilient perspective on my current situation and have backups of backups and have the ability to basically pack in a car with our 72-hour kits, our critical essentials, and these different things so that we could just bug out or go to another place and be okay and basically reestablish all these systems in such a way that we could survive as I built those bigger systems, that the cob oven, the rocket stove ovens, and, you know what I mean, and heaters for the home and the shelter or the new garden. Like, we could be eating sprouts over the winter and survive and be okay because my seed bank is so big. We could eat into it like that. So I would say those things for mm-hmm. sure.
That's awesome. And if you were then arriving on a new site with an eye for creating a design that would be more resilient, you just named a ton of stuff. Let's say you just got there and it's winter. How do you prioritize? Where do you start?
Well, I did just arrive in winter last time on the site. And I basically observed and made plans over and over and over again. As I got ready, I gathered resources, much like, you know, any animal in a natural environment. You assess, you observe, you gather resources, and in that accumulation comes that abundance that allows for improvisation, insight, and adaptation thereof. So I basically got on the site and just started the conversation with the site owner about what I could do, where I could operate, what were the limits. What was he wanting? And so this site, I've got that area that where the garden is. And that's essentially the area that I could work. And it took me time and tinkering to arrive at what I wanted to do. But it's very hard because many of us, you know, arrive in these areas and it's winter, and it's not like Southern California where you're like, well, let's put in the garden. Let's just go for it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's winter. It's literally winter. Like, there's snow on the ground. And so you can't really do much. And then, like, if you're like me and from California, or more recently from California, you are like, well, where's the CSA and where's the fresh food? And you feel completely at the whim of the grocery store, and it's awful and painful to a certain degree because you see this like limp, nasty food and you're like, but I was blessed with good food.
Yep.
You know, and it's painful. I would say that, and what I did was I actually went immediately into planting mode. I set up my greenhouse. And I started reaching out to local communities. I got starts from people who had already grown things, and I plugged them into the ground right in the middle of November. And because it's like, I don't know what the winter is like here, might as well experiment. And so I plugged in a bunch of kale, and the kale's still out there and doing great. I definitely think about be observant, but also experiment, be bold. Test things out. Be of two minds. I know a lot of people are like, oh no, you don't want to be of two minds. You want to be like really sure and certain and confident. And it's like, you also want to hedge your bets. You know, you also want to make sure that, you know, you're saving some of your seed even as you invest it. And that you don't want to use all your seed pack. I never do that. Mm-hmm. I really love having that little bit of seed from that original pack. So yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for doing that deep dive with me on this question. Is there anything I should ask? Is there anything else? Have we brought now unstoppable enthusiasm to this question about threats to our food supply? Anything else you want to mix in?
So I would say that the most important thing to realize with all of this is that everything is within your ability. Everything can be absolutely thrilling, fun, exciting, ultimately rewarding on all holistic levels, intellectually, physically, you know, taste buds, you know, everything. And it's really about just starting somewhere, because the beautiful thing is it's all interconnected. And whether you're starting with fungi or you're starting with your soil and composting, or, you know, you're diving into designing a homestead and or a market garden, it's all going to lead you back to this permaculture lens of earth care, people care, and care of the future. And it's simple, it's elegant. There's a lot of people that'll try to create techniques and say, well, permaculture is this set of techniques and that's permaculture and that's not and whatnot. It's not. It's simply this lens that allows us to see the world through nature's eyes, to problem solve, to have hope and resiliency in trying situations, to find the actual solution to the problem, and to provide beneficially for our families and ourselves on into the future.
Perfect. Matt, there are so many questions I'd love to chat with you about as an entrepreneur, as a parent, but time is flying. So I want to flip to one question I ask of all my guests, and that is this. What do you do for self-care?
Awesome. Well, self-care is really, really near and dear to my heart. I actually just wrote a book called Unstoppable Enthusiasm. It'll be out June 1st on Amazon. I have pre-orders right now on theperMaculturestudent.com under books if you'd like to check it out. But in order to really transcend the anxiety, fear, and stress that regularly comes, you don't just like get over it when you're dealing with cancer in your family, whether it's you or the person you love most in the world or your child. You don't like just like, well, I'm no longer anxious about that. No, it comes in waves. It comes back. It comes with new angles at you. And so I really had to rise above all that to lead my family, to support my wife, to inspire them to bring joy, enthusiasm to our daily lives so that we don't have this ping pong effect of negativity, despair, and fear in our home. And so for me, I really had to dig deep into this. And to just basically describe what's in the book, I have routines, morning, evening, and hourly, daily routines that I do that reignite my enthusiasm. And what is enthusiasm? Well, it's enthusiasm really is what makes us feel alive. It's that thing that people say, whoa, that was so graceful. That was inspired. Listen to that music. Look at that performance. That idea is brilliant. It's just so inspirational. I'm so inspired by your performance. It's actually this feeling within us that wells up and even lifts our chest. It makes us feel, it causes chills. We feel it on the back of our neck. Our heart speeds up. But we recognize it. It's something that's recognizable in ancient philosophies, religions have all recognized it, whether it's the spirit of God within us, the spirit of life within us, whether, you know, it's getting in touch with the field, the quantum field, whatever you want to call it, it is recognizable. And when we do that, when we unlock those states, we arrive at our best selves. We arrive at this peace, this clarity that allows us to steer through all that difficulty and negativity and fear and get kind of above that forest and see the valley for what it is and train for what it is and see where you actually want to go. And so that's what I've had to do in my own personal life. And I couldn't be forced. Like I said earlier, it really had to be grown out of an honest, authentic, gentle place. And so I start every morning expressing gratitude. I've got words I read that are affirmations. And affirmations just are statements that you believe or want to believe, that fill you up with confidence, that fill you up with a feeling of joy, excitement, and love. And so I start with those. I have words I read like, let me just grab them. But yeah. So I will not be slowed down by those afraid to try. This is my day and I will make it great. I will send the child of God those in me today. I will choose what is right even when it is hard. I will honor the journey. I will show love, patience, and kindness. I will grow with nature knowing that I too am always changing and learning. Stuff like that. And those kind of things are ideally what you want is the soundtrack, the sub soundtrack of your day. And so I do those, and if I'm having a hard day, I'll go back to them and repeat them to myself. But then from there, I either dive into meditation or yoga or writing. I'm a writer, and so writing is how I'll alter my reality in many ways. And new ideas and creation and reflection. And so I've got like a daily planner I do. I do Qigong. So I'm waking up my body and my internal organs. It looks like self-flagellation when you're using knuckles on bone and stuff, but it really works out. It's really good, especially when you're falling out with slapping and redistributing all that stuff that you just did. So I do that. I do a lot of like really maybe to some people intense meditation. So I do like 55 minutes of meditation almost every single morning. And to get to that level of unstoppable enthusiasm, I really visualize the things that bring me enthusiasm. And then I've gone even further. And now this is a secret from my book. When you have unstoppable enthusiasm, there are very certain indicators, very particular indicators that you and I already know. And those are, can you be enthusiastic about being enthusiastic? And when people actually think about that in their life, and when they realize what it actually is, it's actually a self-generating energy machine. Because if you can be excited about being excited, then you create this energy machine, but that can go to exuberance and over-enthusiasm. But if you're tied up to what makes you feel most alive in a centered, deep way, you actually recognize that other people have their own deeply centered, and you it creates this respect for other people, and you stay really connected to other people. It doesn't go into that over-enthusiasm thing. So I really fundamentally believe in doing this kind of work so that you can really become centered. And so I do this meditation. I literally cue unstoppable enthusiasm in my body, in my mind, and I visualize in an alpha brainwave state. Basically, I'm self-hypnotizing through this meditation process. And then I'm cueing these emotions in that state. And so I'm rewriting sections of my brain. And by taking things I don't like in that state and then letting them go and replacing them with things I do like, I'm actually making it so that when those problems do come up during the day, those fears do come up during the day, I have that automatic paired response to them where I'm remembering, no, I got this. I got this. And feeling that return of those emotional states. And just like you go to bed stressed, you wake up stressed more often. And if you go to bed stressed every night for a period of time, you start waking up stressed more and more until that's just your natural habit. And then that habit extends out. It goes from being a mood to a habit to a personality, and it creates your personal reality. That's what Joe Dispenza always says. And so it's really incredibly important that we recognize that we have this opportunity to actually change our perception and cue the emotions and feelings in our body that we want to feel. So I, at the end of every night, I'm writing down my gratitudes in my gratitude journal. I'm picking out with my mind all the things in my day that were the blessings, that were the amazing things that happened that I really, truly appreciated. And I'm ending my day on that note. So that when my brain starts doing its cleaning process, the glial cells start cleaning things out and start setting my brain for the next day, they actually take a snapshot of your previous day. And if you focused on gratitude that last hour of the day, it snapshots that. And you wake up in the morning feeling more grateful, having more enthusiasm, because you wrote down what's the most important thing to you and you feel the most grateful for. Those are the things that are enthusiasm builders, enthusiasm reinforcers, supporters, catalysts. And so you wake up as a habit more and more in enthusiasm. And so these states then begin to start bleeding into each other. And so you start having that meditation you do, the effect may have gone away after an hour, your first year doing it. And then, you know, the second year it's 4 hours, but then you start doing these hourly checkups that you do. And then they're like these upticks, and then they cause this extension on these states. And these really are just states. And we recognize days that we wake up and we feel just alive. The air, the sun, the air outside feels amazing. And we just feel so good. Well, that's actually a brain state. That's actually a mental process in your brain that you can train yourself to feel. And there are reasons you feel that way. There are literal things you're telling yourself, assumptions you're making about your future, and idealized perhaps lenses through which you're looking at the people around you. But like you literally are seeing the world through a certain state and grappling with that and understanding that, and maybe even injecting some reality into that is really healthy. That's why I said sometimes you're not seeing the world for what it is. And it's only through the reflection process that you actually face those realities, those reactions, and update it and become more real. And then because of that, you become more realistic about what you're talking about and more resilient as you step out into your hope, as you step out on that limb of taking a chance, being courageous. You gain the ability to be more courageous because you know your footing, you know your grounding. And you're centered and people can't knock you off even when they try. So I'm 2.5 years now into meditating every day. And it is absolutely the way that I cue my enthusiasm. I reset. When I go to the dentist, I literally put myself into a meditative, like, alpha brainwave state. And they think I'm napping. They're like, are you awake? I'm like, yes. I'm like, okay. And at the end, they're like, you know, nice nap. And I'm like, yeah. And some of the like, I do breathing thing. I do the Wim Hof and stuff like that. I do cold therapy sometimes. I have to be careful with it because I have I just have like tightness things happening sometimes. And if I do cold, I know that there's the inflammation release and stuff, but there's the initial seizing of the body in sometimes cold. And I can't always do that. Though I am a huge fan of cold. Don't get me wrong. I'm a firm believer in it. I'm all about it. But I think physically, just like Wim Hof says, we need to be prepared to handle the stress. So that's just a snapshot of some of the things I do. I have a lot more, just like that indicator of being, you know, enthusiastic about enthusiasm. Some of the other indicators for unstoppable enthusiasm are spontaneous dancing, spontaneous laughter. When we do those things, we are literally in that state where we feel like anything's possible. We feel free and liberated. And in that mental state, we can reach our highest potentials.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. It's great to hear how conscious you are and just how much mindfulness you bring to each day. It's just refreshing. And hey, whatever you're doing, it's working because you are just a wealth of knowledge and a true inspiration. So I will be headed shortly to thepermaculturestudent.com to pre-order Unstoppable Enthusiasm. I've already got my Permaculture Student 2 here, which is just an amazing work. It's really well done. It's beautifully produced. And you've got an amazing cast of characters involved too. What was it like to work with such a super group of people there?
So for me, I didn't unlock my potential as a student until I was in a one-on-one situation in 7th through 9th grade at a special ski racing school where we had 20-minute, 25-minute classes. And I was taught one-on-one. And I was one of those kids that had a real hard time in school. They wanted to put me on drugs. I was in special ed classes. But I scored really, really high on a standardized test. They thought I cheated because they couldn't believe that I could do that. And so for me, I actually need to ask an inexorbitant amount of questions. So, and most of the time I go quickly outside of the understanding of a public school teacher, because by the time I reached fifth grade, I had read almost all the books in my attic as a child. So I was an avid reader from a very young age. And so working one-on-one with these teachers really was like, I got to go back to school and be this student again that at the most transformative time in my life. So it was like super humbling, but also really comforting, because it was like, I felt also that I had a teaching community again, because I was a student teacher, then a master teacher, but I come from a network of teachers. And I always ran things through my students and this network of teachers and thought about all the responses whenever I did anything. I always love reflecting. So I really found it so empowering and absolutely amazing to be able to bounce ideas off of Dr. Lane Ingham, Peter McCoy, and now Dan Kittredge, and now David R. Montgomery, and all these experts in their fields. So you have like a soil food web expert, you have a mycology expert, you have a geomorphology expert, you know, you've got a farmer who's focused on bionutrients, and having this conversation and being like, no, that's wrong because of this, but why is it right on the test, you know, and then having all these things and being the actual facilitative mycelium between them all now was absolutely incredible. So I got to not only get the kind of education that fed me at the deepest level, allowed me to ask all my questions, allowed me to bring my most enthusiastic and curious, you know, questions to the table, but it really opened up this door that changed permaculture altogether. So I found myself in the position where all these experts were coaching me. It was so enjoyable. I was able to be like this equal because I was understanding what they were saying because they had all taught me one-on-one. And now we're asking these higher level questions. And suddenly I was asking questions that they were going, well, whoa. And so it felt like really, really good. And meanwhile, these are like novice questions. These are like questions that like a child would ask, I feel like, if they were in a similar position with experts being like, well, why can't we do that? Mm-hmm. And then being like, well, this experiment that we did, and then we dive into the actuals, and then we get someplace totally different. And then they're like, well, I guess considering that, you know, it would be really interesting if we experimented and tried that specific, and it snowballed over and over again. Even today I'm writing, I was rewriting a section in the Permaculture Student 2, adding caveats in there. So I say that, you know, bacteria digest simple compounds in there. But in recent years, we've discovered some pretty ridiculous things. Like we found bacteria that can digest wood lignin. And yeah, it's rare, you know what I mean? But having that caveat in there creates this complex view of the world, which creates this respect for the world, which creates this ability to be like, yeah, but there's more things that can happen here. In the student, in the scientist, in the inventor, innovator. So yeah, no, I really, really value diving deep into all this with experts one-on-one because of that. I've been able to arrive, because I am the permaculture student. Like that's the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I am the student. And if I go to the guru side of things, I'll stop being a student and I'll calcify it. And I don't want to ever do that. So, it's been absolutely incredible, and it's been always a constant expansive thing. And at times it is hard because they do disagree at times, but why they disagree is so fascinating. So I'm always trying to bring that, always trying to bridge that, and also be the scientist instead of being the dogmatic guru religious scientist, because so much of our science nowadays is basically religion, mm-hmm. where they believe it because the textbook said it, because the experts said it, because I've got him confused with, you know, God in my mind. Like, no one can question Neil deGrasse. And it's like, well, why not? He's a scientist, and science is the process of questions and seeking out new information and answers.
Could not agree more.
So it was absolutely incredible, and it changed me entirely in my approach to permaculture, because of how much learning I took on board. And that's why that purple book that you have there mm-hmm. is so expansive. That's why it has social permaculture. It has, you know, social principles and urban permaculture and case studies. I mean, you'll find that case studies are pretty rare when you look at these books.
And it's full color. It's beautiful. Yeah.
So the next question here is, the permaculturestudent.com, the best place for people to find your books, and how else can we support you?
That's right.
So if you would like to read my book today, to learn things that you can do today, go to the permaculturestudent.com and download that book that he just showed you. It's literally free. It's over 400 pages. It's absolutely ridiculously life-changing information. And he has them always add caveats into it where I can, finding the latest study, adding things. But the information in there is gold. There's no other place with that information. There's no other collection that has it organized the way that's iterated out that allows you to actually be able to develop your lens from micro to macro. So yeah, we're always adding to it. We're always adding new things into it. Something that's not in there that I'm going to be adding soon is chitinase. So chitinase is really incredible. It allows us to digest chitin. So that's insect exoskeleton. That's the cell walls of fungi. So in other words, your fungal blights, your pests on your tomatoes, you can create a compost tea with insect frass in the mix or vermicompost and then melt them. So, you want to be careful with the bees, right? You don't want to melt the bees. But like, we literally have the ability to do things naturally. And I keep adding to it because the new research keeps coming. And so I'm always constantly updating that. But the book is there. It will literally launch you into a totally new different area. I basically covered, you know, some of the updates that I'm doing for it. So you can research what I've just talked about in addition to what you're getting in there to broaden that experience for you. But that book is free because I believe it's a human right to know how to live on planet Earth, to be a participant in nature. I believe it's a right to know how to participate in the natural world that we live in. Because we come from nature and we return to it. I mean, that is the truth. That is the ultimate truth, that we all will return to soil, and we all are built out of the food that is built out of the soil. So, yeah, I would say go to the permaculturestudent.com, checking out the free books, checking out the free mini courses. I've got a lot of awesome mini courses like the Your Best Garden on there. Goes over all the stuff that I've talked about in depth. And then I've got courses on there. I've got permaculture gardening. I've got the Advanced Permaculture Student Online, which actually pairs with that purple book. And you could actually get on a payment plan there for, you know, $50 a month. You know, and there's scholarship for $500 for the total program, which is half the price of like all the other PDCs that you see out there. And I have a PDC plus an advanced PDC, which means that you actually make a real project and it's real for you. And so you actually can take that step into making it your life. So I would go there, check those things out. The books are on there right now. The books are also on Amazon, but the sets and the nice prices are on my website, at least for right now, because I do orders and batches of the books so they can get them at a lower price for people like you. So that you can go there and get them at a more reasonable price. Because it's hard to make things reasonable priced on Amazon because of the way they structure the pricing and the printing. So yeah, I would go to thepromocodestudent.com, check out the books, sign up for a free course. Just, you know, get going because there is so much stuff there that's free and fun for you to make a difference today in your life.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Matt, I cannot thank you enough for joining me today. I would love to have another conversation in the future if you're up for it.
I would absolutely love to come back and discuss parenting, you know, more of the social permaculture side, more of the self-care, whatever you know you're into. I think about it also constantly that it's always kind of there at the tip of my tongue. And I really just appreciate you creating this platform to spread these ideas, to showcase so many of the people that you are showcasing on your podcast and show, so that people everywhere can know and understand the amazing options that we have before us for living an extraordinary life that is ethically congruent. And that is beautiful too. So thank you.
Well, thank you for that. It's been my pleasure. And folks, that is Building Resilience with Unstoppable Enthusiasm with Matt Powers. Thanks, Matt. We'll speak soon.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. And a huge thanks to Matt Powers again for joining me. And thanks to you for listening. Folks, if you made it this far, consider supporting my work via patreon.com/iceagefarmer and checking out the latest on iceagefarmer.com. Let's go build great things.